Hey, Fab.
Hey, Charles. What's going on?
Doing well. How's it been going for you?
Great.
Yeah, I had some time off this weekend. I feel like I actually enjoyed the weekend a bit more. I still hate Mondays, but...
Well, I'm a happy camper because the NBA finals are back. So I'm just so excited to have basketball back in my life again.
Well, definitely one episode we're going to talk all about sports.
Awesome. So can't wait.
You'll get your wish. But I think I need to make a public apology here.
Okay.
And, you know, usually I'm kind of a stubborn person.
I know. You're kind of taking me by surprise a bit. You didn't run this by me when we talked.
Well, no. And I kind of feel like, you know, this is an important issue. And, you know, when you're wrong about something, but you don't really realize how wrong you've been about it?
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that you thought about it this much when we last talked.
Huh?
Wait, you're not apologizing to me?
This isn't about you, Fab.
Why are you setting me up?
But no, I'm talking about teachers.
Oh, teachers. Why do you need to apologize to teachers?
So, you know I have two kids.
Yes, I do know.
I do talk about having two kids because it really makes life very, very challenging. But this whole situation with homeschooling, it just really, like, I've always appreciated teachers. I myself am the product of some really great and amazing teachers in my life who, by the way, I'm still friends with on Facebook.
Really?
I'm actually friends
with some of my teachers too.
I'm friends with my second grade teacher.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Shout out to Miss Butler. She's still like out there doing her thing.
I don't think I remember who my second grade teacher was.
Oh, no. So the reason I remember Miss Butler is because I actually had a crush on her in second grade.
Of course.
And so, yeah, shout out to Miss Butler. So the experience of teaching my own children has opened my eyes to what teachers have to go through on a daily basis teaching not just my kids, but everyone else's kids.
So you're advocating for them to get raises?
I would, not just raises. I think teachers should be, right, because a raise is just a one-time thing, right? Like, I think their salaries should really speak to the amount of work, sacrifice, effort, thought, heart. Because they're not just doing content, they're not just teaching material. They're actually taking care of our kids.
It's so ironic to me that one of the most important positions socially, right, is one of the poorest paid. If you think about what teachers are responsible of doing and ushering our children, the new generation,
yeah,
and that they don't earn five figures,
yeah,
to me, that is insane.
It is criminal when other, we can call it far less impactful positions, and we just talked about sports. I love sports, but let's be real here. It's not raising the generation the way that teachers are. Even people who are actors, I think they do phenomenal work. I think it's commendable, the energy and the talent it takes, but it's not teaching.
It definitely is not. And I don't think we figure out exactly how we should be rewarding teachers, or we've taken for granted how just important they are. And this COVID situation has really brought to light that if it's difficult to teach your own kids, imagine, yes, having to teach 30 kids classroom
that aren't yours.
That aren't yours.
Like, I don't even like teaching my kids, and they're mine.
Yeah, it's definitely hard work.
So teachers, thank you, and I apologize. I will show up differently. I totally promise.
So I don't know if you know this about me. I used to be a teacher aide.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Look at that.
I worked for special education when I first graduated from college.
Wow.
And I realized that I did not have what it takes to be a teacher. It was just not my thing. So I have a deep appreciation for those teachers that not only show up every day, but do it with love and passion and a lot of care.
Totally. So speaking about teachers, obviously, if you haven't been aware, there's a huge conflict nationwide, but also around the world, about the decision to either reopen schools for in-person learning or remain virtual until this pandemic is under control.
Yes, we can't seem to agree which way to go.
I mean, it's a very polarizing conversation, and it's one that we think is really worth having, not just in this platform, but in general, because there are so many people who are very passionate about either direction. And for us, you know, in our own conversations, it really makes us kind of wonder, when we're hearing both sides of this, what is this really about? You know, is this about kids returning to school for the sake of education, for a better tomorrow? Or is this really about getting the economy back on track? So as always, we ask you to take this journey with us as we discuss a return to schools. What is this really about?
This is, in my opinion, a course-sized seat into the sometimes quirky and lively conversation between two friends from grad school. We talk about everything and nothing, blending social commentary with strong opinions, often entertaining, sometimes serious, and all the way civil. You know, the way you wish the world would be.
So as we usually do, our goal in this conversation is not to favor one side or the other. Right. And we hope that by simply presenting the perspectives and some of the facts, that you as the audience can be in a better position to make a more informed decision. And so before we kind of get into the meat of all this, I think it's important for us to just have a bit of context. I mean, how many of us really know and understand the history and evolution of public schools in America?
Yeah, you know, I think this is such an interesting conversation in that I first did not really understand how schools evolve in the United States other than the major sort of key points. But one of the things that's really interesting is that education primarily around the 1800s, early 1900s, primarily happened at home. And this was sort of a system that really favored wealthier parents that can afford to bring tutors into the home and teach kids several languages if necessary, different courses like math and science and literature. But for most children, what they learn at home were basic elementary age courses. Because the parents were responsible for that. And it wasn't until the late, I believe, 19th century, that school became a mandatory thing, but only up to elementary school age. And after that, kids weren't really responsible for attending school like they are now. Kids are supposed to be in school until they are 18, mm-hmm. or they get their GED. But legally, kids have to go to school from kindergarten all the way to high school. And another thing that was really different was that typically there was one teacher that taught a class of different age children, and she taught several lessons and courses all at once or all on the same day. And she was primarily, and I say she because it was usually a female, and it would usually be someone that was unmarried, but the townspeople would usually paid her salary and boarding. And she was responsible for educating all of the kids up to an elementary school level. And I thought that was really, really interesting. And as school evolved in several states, Massachusetts and Connecticut were one of the leading ones that started petitioning for more access to public schools for kids, then it really started to really develop. But it wasn't until the 1960s that school became for everyone, because kids of color in America were not guaranteed an education the same way as other kids.
And that was around the time of Brown versus
the Board of Education. Right?
Yep. And I think that that context, just all of the history of that, is really important as it kind of pivots us to where we are now, because what schools were initially designed for, and it still does serve a function of educating and teaching. But I thought it was interesting that even from its early inception, there was a disparity between access to education. Like, I thought that that didn't happen until later, particularly around issues of racism that we mentioned. But even at the very beginning, there was access for affluent families that weren't afforded to those without.
Right. And, you know, and I feel a little silly because as I think about foreign films or dated films that I've watched, and you always see in those movies where there's a tutor that comes over to teach the kids. And I really took for granted that what that meant was if you were wealthy enough, then you can afford to have a separate tutor for each different course, or even a tutor that can teach you enough so that you can be affluent in society. And everyone else was probably relegated to having the medial work, working at the mines, working manual labor, the farms, and those kind of things.
And even if the tutor, let's say for sake of argument, wasn't even that great, just that level of attention to have a one-on-one experience with someone versus being in a classroom of 20, 30 kids with one teacher, you know, that disparity alone changes how you get information, the amount of attention and help that you get. I mean, ratios in classrooms are actually a proven barometer for how kids are able to absorb what they learn.
It blew my mind that one teacher would teach everyone in the town, because what it makes me think of, I had a lot of great teachers, yeah. But I had the occasional bad teacher. And can you imagine if that was your bad teacher, or that you just didn't see eye to eye? You were stuck with her for the rest of your life.
And so was the town.
And so was the town, yes.
Well, so I guess in that case, thanks for, it's great to have some variety. But again, you know, having this context and kind of juxtaposing it to where we are now, I think is really key. And so we want to take this in kind of two bites, right? And look a bit at what are the arguments that are for reopening schools. And when I say when we talk about reopening, we're talking about the actual physical spaces, right? Like actually going back to a building, being around other people. The ideas are around maintaining proper social distancing practices. But that's what we mean when we say for going back to school. And we also are going to talk about the arguments that are against this idea of returning to physical spaces. So kind of tackling the first one, and these are things that we have researched and just in kind of different pockets are hearing arguments that support a return to physical spaces in schools. And so the first one is that, again, considering this in context to the economy, you know, there are many families who rely on schools as a safe place to keep their children for sometimes up to 10 hours a day, if you count after school, while they themselves are going to work, trying to make income so that they can be able to maintain sometimes even just a bare minimum lifestyle for them and their families.
Yeah, so schools are such a lifeline for so many families. Not only do the families depend on sending their kids to school for education, but it's also a place for them to be safe, to have shelter, to have food, and to really be taken care of and nurtured. And I think that's part of this evolution of the public education system, where kids would go to school previously for a few hours to get content. Now, schools have become this really one-stop shop for so many basic needs. And if parents aren't able to send their kids to school, what happens to those children while schools are closed?
Right. And who's taking care of them?
Right.
And if a family has to make a decision between having their child be in a safe place, like a school building, versus then having to stay home with them, not only could that mean a reduced income if they can find jobs that are flexible or that allow them to kind of navigate that so they can stay home while making income, but some families may have to actually forego income altogether. And that can only make things worse.
And I know, Charles, you always talk about your two kids.
Yes, I have two kids.
But a lot of families I know have three kids, four kids, five kids. So we're not even just thinking about what it means to keep one or two kids in school. What do you do when you have several children in different grade levels and you live in a one-bedroom or two-bedroom apartment? And what does that do for the mental health of the child and the well-being of that family unit?
And I think the mental health part of this is something that often gets overlooked. Mental health covers many different aspects, both from the physical side of it, but also the emotional side of things. And, you know, being in spaces that are sometimes not ideal spaces, having the option to be able to go somewhere for a few hours, I know I appreciate that. And we have, you know, thankfully, you know, adequate space for everyone in our family. And even then, I still feel like I need my own space, my own escape, just for my own sanity.
Yeah. And in our last episode, you know, I talked to you about that. School has always been my thing. Yeah. I was like a bit of a nerd, and I love school. Part of the reason why I love school is because I am the oldest of five. So going to school was a reprieve for me. Hmm. It was just getting away from not having privacy, everyone being in your business, and really being in a full house all of the time. That when I was in school, it really was a different place for me where I could flourish a little bit differently than I could at home.
So we also kind of already mentioned a bit the meal portion of this and how so many families rely on school as a source of just being fed. And having the ability to have that meal option through school also helps to really provide much needed support from families, not just financially, but in other ways as well.
Yeah, I know that you've mentioned in previous episodes just how much money you spend on food when your kids are home. I can imagine that food is a huge part of a family's budget. And when they are not in school, that significantly impacts how much money they have for other things, to pay bills and other things that they typically need to do.
So true. And the next point in this argument, and again, we are kind of listing those arguments that are for the reopening of schools, is that it continues to exacerbate the gaps between more affluent and wealthy families who can afford private tutors and those families that are lower income and may not have access to that. So, for example, families who are relying on a physical space and a professional teacher at that building to be the one to help educate their children on, I mean, the Common Core thing alone has, it's been a nightmare for me. And I'm a grad school level education and I don't get Common Core. I can only imagine the struggles for so many other families, especially if that's not a system that you grew up in.
So I have to full disclosure here because I'm really speaking.
Did you create Common Core?
I did not. Thank okay. God. I did not want to be associated with that curriculum. But I don't have children, right? So I feel like I'm speaking from a place of privilege, in the sense that I don't have to personally worry about these things. But I do worry for the many people that I know that do have children. And one of the things that when I help my niece, who is in second grade, do her homework, I have felt stupid. They're using a curriculum that is so different than what I used as a kid. And to me, it makes absolutely no logical sense. I mean, 2 + 2 = 4. I don't know why we're drawing little figures to figure that out. It makes it so complicated. So like you, I worry about how many families actually have the time, the resources, or if they have multiple children that can really keep up with the curriculum. Teachers go to a master's program to become teachers. They get lots of training. They have a curriculum to follow. Parents don't have that.
So there's actually a really funny video on YouTube. I don't know if you've seen it.
I think I sent that to you.
Oh, did you send it
yes.
to me? About the woman
the dad drinking coffee?
She made a fresh pot of coffee and played with her dog.
Yeah.
After she already solved. So it's like a split screen. One side of the screen is a teacher that's in a classroom with a multiple choice, not a multiple choice.
Doing Common Core,
A problem in a Common Core method. And then on the right side of the screen is a woman who is just literally doing the multiplication like we all learned.
The old school way.
From the back of the book.
Yeah.
Takes like 3 seconds to complete the answer.
I think the problem was 5 times 30.
30.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's literally, the video is over 5 minutes because that's how long it took the teacher to give what really should have been a very quick and simple answer.
Yes.
And it was just hilarious seeing this woman make a fresh pot of coffee. She took her dog outside, played fetch, and then came back. And then the teacher was still going with the same problem.
Yeah.
So yeah, kudos to Common Core. So some other perspectives on this, again, in favor of reopening schools, is that teachers have a professional obligation to return to schools.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
This is interesting, right? Like if I try to kind of challenge myself, my innate reaction was like, why do they? Right? Why do they have a professional responsibility? I got to work from home when the crisis first started. So why can they? But then I also think about how we have labeled some people essential and non-essential, right? Are teachers considered essential when it comes to either society, the economy, and so forth.
Yeah.
And you know, what's really ironic about that term, essential and non-essential, is that who seems to be essential are our lowest paid professionals.
Yeah.
So in a moment of crisis, we depend on the cashiers and the supermarket workers and teachers and police officers and firemen and all of that. They don't get a break. They don't get to an alternate plan for the crises. But they are not valued the same way that some other professions are.
I think that's a great point. And you're, you know, even just talking about how that term essential has its, has a convenient use to it.
Right.
You know, when it suits a narrative, when it helps, you know, in whatever way someone wants to use it, then that term gets thrown around, but it's not then exemplified in all the other areas that you mentioned. You know, I also feel that this statement is unfair, but it's one that I think a lot of people do believe, that kind of in the same way that doctors have a Hippocratic oath, you know, to and lawyers, right? We could argue whether or not they follow it, but it exists. That there's also kind of this contract for teachers that when they go into a profession, come hell or high water, come good times and bad times, come crisis and not, the expectation is you're supposed to be there for the kids.
Right, because it's almost like this double-sided argument, right? In that, in the one hand, in my line of work, I deal a lot with truancy, right? And kids who do not go to school, police officers can pick them up if they see them in the street during school time, hours, and so forth. We have laws that created that kids must be in school when schools are open. So at the same token, does that mean if kids have to be in schools, does that mean that teachers also have to be in school? And it's really an interesting argument that we've never had to answer before.
Totally fair point. So that's our list of arguments, not our personal list, but lists that represent many of the views and perspectives of people who are for the reopening of schools. And now we're going to take a quick look at the argument that is against the return to physical spaces. So the first one that we'll look at is that when you look at, you know, and Fab did a great job at providing context to the evolution of it, part of that evolution also kind of reminds you how old, not just the school system, but a lot of the buildings themselves are that house children and teachers and other admin that really aren't even equipped with proper ventilation. A lot of these schools are requiring to purchase portable ventilation systems, which are not the best and kind of more of an ad hoc response. And even just having enough space and physical structure to be able to effectively practice safe distances.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. Did you go to high school here in the U.S.? Or
I didn't.
So I went to high school here in the U.S., public school. And I loved the school that I went to, but it was the oldest building. And I saw it a few years back. It's still there. It still looks exactly the same. And that was my experience with every school that I attended in New York City. There's always these older buildings that back in the 90s or 80s had a whole bunch of asbestos and different lead and things going on with them. And we don't really have a really innovative or new learning spaces for kids, right? Unless they're going to a private school an innovative charter school or so forth. So our buildings are a big, big problem.
Yeah, and it's one that I think is a very, very fair argument for people to consider in return to physical spaces. Because if the space itself isn't safe, then, you know, does it make sense to even re-enter that building? Another argument that goes against the return to physical spaces is the consideration of just people's health, and particularly teachers. There was one survey that was done that found that over 28% of public school teachers are over the age of 50. But in consideration to a situation like COVID, that age bracket is particularly vulnerable to this type of virus. And so consideration for safety for particularly those members of the teaching staff, that's of serious concern.
Yeah, so age is a risk factor for COVID for sure. But I'm also thinking about, in addition to age, how many teachers may have pre-existing conditions that make them more vulnerable to go into a classroom and teach. In America, unfortunately, we're not the healthiest population. Our healthcare is not the best. And we do not know what kind of medical health conditions people are facing. And I think this pandemic has really highlighted how many of us have poor health. To ask somebody to choose between their health and their job seems like a moral and ethical safety problem.
I think it totally is. And again, this is what kind of leads us to wonder, you know, what's really behind these decisions? Because if you have to make those kinds of choices, then there's something wrong. And to not be forgotten, you know, we're talking about teachers and their health. We could argue that kids themselves are, can we say, magnets?
Oh my God, yes.
Magnets for germs? I mean...
Yes. So when I was a teacher aide, I remember my first week. And the reason I remember it is because I got the flu immediately after starting. And it's almost like an ongoing joke. Yeah. It's like the newbie immediately gets sick when they come into a school building.
It's like a rite of passage.
Right. Because kids have so many germs.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times... Because I've also had worked with schools in different capacities, not directly as a teacher. And sometimes I would just sit and just watch, not in like, you know, a way.
Yeah, I was wondering where you were going with this story.
But just like, you know, like on a lunch break and you see kids just kind of playing and interacting.
Yeah.
And then you see them like put their finger in their nose or cough on someone or sneeze and then just immediately engage and touch, like just... shaking someone's hand, and I'm literally just taking notes of the kids that's doing this, so I know exactly who to avoid.
And we already know how you feel about handkerchiefs.
Yes.
But
kids with handkerchiefs, oh my God.
Oh, can you imagine?
That's a horror story.
But yeah, like kids are famously known to come up to you and sneeze right in your face before they speak, right? Like kids don't have this concept of hygiene down pat when they're little, and I will argue some older kids haven't learned it yet either. Walk into any school building in America and it is a funky place.
You know what? I think I just came to the realization that the kids like that who were spreading germs probably grew up to be adults who use handkerchiefs. I think you've helped me crack the connection. I think that's what
or
it is.
Or maybe not, right? I don't know. It depends how you look at it. But yeah, kids are gross. I love them, but they are gross. And expecting them to be able to understand physical distance, social distance, keeping their hands to themselves, all of those things that they're still kind of not used to yet, I think it's unrealistic.
It is. And it just adds to the work and stress that teachers already feel when you're trying to teach a curriculum and keep a class focused and centered and dealing with you know, so much else that's going on. And then on top of that, you have to worry about keeping kids apart, not touching each other. And kids are naturally just very social beings.
So some parts of our country have already decided to open up schools. And in Georgia, I believe they opened up schools. And on the first day, these pictures became highly public because kids were just walking in the hallway, saying hello to their friends, really close to each other. And there was absolutely no social distance. And if you ever in a school between periods when the bell rings and people come out, it is like a herd.
Yeah.
A herd of small little humans like walking through. And it's just really difficult to think that we can keep kids separated in a school building.
And so the last part of this argument that we wanted to talk about that I think is also really at the heart of how a lot of teachers themselves and even families feel about this push to return back to schools is that it almost kind of feels like schools... kids, teachers, faculty are kind of becoming test labs for a very serious situation that doesn't even have a vaccine yet. And out of all of the kind of large gatherings and large groups to make a push to return, it just doesn't seem like schools are the spaces and the places to do that.
Yeah, it definitely does seem like they're guinea pigs, right? And, you know, I mentioned how excited I am that the NBA is back. And I think about all the work they had to do to resume the season. They're staying in a bubble, right? They call this the bubble because everyone is quarantined. They're not allowed to have visitors. They get tested, I believe, daily. And so forth. And they have all of these thought out safety precautions for entertainment. Yeah. Right? Although you can argue that it's needed during this time. I personally need it. But it's not really an essential thing. In contrast, right? They are, what, like 60 basketball players in this league?
Yeah.
Or maybe closer to 100. But they are millions of teachers and students. And we have safety precautions for almost everything but this. And it really makes me wonder what is really the driving force here and why is this necessary?
Again, it just seems that it's also prioritizing those who are not financially well off because they're not in a position oftentimes to have options. And so for them, it kind of becomes this thing of, well, either you deal with it or you find some other way to make a living. And I think that's a horrible space to put families in when, you know, people who have access and means to things, you know, can have the option, like we mentioned before, to have private tutors or to even relocate to a place that's much safer or that kind of has these practices more thought out. It just doesn't seem like it's a good thing to, when you involve especially children and people who genuinely just don't want to return to work and they've are feeling like they're forced to do so.
Yeah, I think like if you're a working class family, I think you are in a terrible position, right? I have people, colleagues that have children and they are extremely anxious because they do not know how they can do both, right? How can they remain employed and also have their kids at home? Or if they send their kids to school, they're worried about their health. They worry about their kids bringing something back, particularly like if an older grandparent lives at home or a parent that or a family member that might have health vulnerabilities. So it's almost like it's a lose-lose situation for families. And it seems like the only two choices that we've given them is either, you know, risk your health and send them to school so that you can keep your job, or you can protect your health and keep them at home, but then lose your income and potentially be homeless because you can't afford to pay your rent or your mortgage or so forth.
Yeah, I think it really does seem like a lose-lose situation for those families. And I think that's a great point to bring up. And, you know, we didn't want to just present these two sides and perspectives to you without also some considerations. You know, as there are many professionals and people who are trying to kind of figure this thing all out. And, you know, for a lot of states, you know, that have decided to reopen physical spaces for schools, they've already begun to see some of the ramifications of that. And even here in New York, you know, teachers are, you know, kind of making decisions to even protest against the reopening. And so there have been some different ideas that have been floating around, and we wanted to share those with you, again, to help you be informed, especially if either you are yourself attending school or have children or family members or friends whose children are thinking about going back to physical spaces or instead staying home for virtual learning. And so some of these ideas are remaining virtual until it's safer to return, right? So just simply not going back and allowing there to be safe distances, staying home, learning virtually.
But what that would mean, though, is that working families would need a solution for daycare or something figured out for them so that they're able to remain at work.
Totally. Another option, and this is one courtesy of the White House, is because schools, in part, are paid through federal tax, that the idea is if parents aren't returning to schools and that money then shouldn't go to the schools themselves. It should actually be given to the parents to use maybe as a way to hire a tutor or even just towards their own income.
And you know, this seems like a really great idea on the surface, but realistically, the federal government pays for about 10% of the whole school budgets throughout the state, and they primarily help with subsidizing like school lunch and school nutrition. I don't know the last time you ate a school lunch, Charles, but it is definitely not a lot of money. It's about like $3 per child that gets spent for school lunches. So although this is sounds like a really great idea, it would be very small amount.
And another idea is teaching outdoors. And I've heard this idea kind of being floated around in different districts. But certainly, obviously, doing so when it's kind of when weather permits, right? So maybe kind of prioritizing certain seasons, you know, when it's safe and the conditions are right to do so. But the idea here is to still be able to meet in person with enough distance and outdoors, which is even better because, I mean, there's no better ventilation than the outside.
Than fresh air, yeah, right? Fresh air. And there's actually some countries who are doing this already. And this seems like an actually really cool idea that I think we should spend more time thinking about.
And the last idea, or at least the one that we're going to present here in this podcast, although there are many other ideas that are floating around, is to create actual virtual curriculum. And at first I thought this was like, duh. But interestingly, most often teachers in this virtual space are just being told to teach virtually, but not actually using virtual-based curriculum.
Right. I have a 6-year-old niece and a 4-year-old, and they are experts in using their iPads. Kids are so technological savvy. They spend so much time in the screens. Why don't we have a virtual curriculum or even a virtual like educational channel that really focuses on in-house instruction? And that would really resolve like the parents that aren't able to navigate Common Core or different grade levels. And it could create a way for kids to, not only kids who can afford tutors, to get that additional support and resource that they need at home for free.
I think it's a great idea. And, you know, part of, you know, my thinking around it as well is that it's not just a simple switch to just go from a classroom, take that material, and then teach it over the internet.
Right. We like to take old things and bring them to new situations and expect them to succeed. Yeah. And what we really need here is that we need to create a whole new thing because this is a new experience. And as long as I've been alive, we've never gone through anything quite like this. Yeah. So thinking that an old system is going to fit into a new system really is a bit short-sighted on our part. And we really haven't set our teachers up to succeed because I attend Zoom meetings all the time and they are the least efficient meetings that you can possibly have because it's really hard to stay focused during the whole time, let alone expect kids from 5 through 17 to be able to sit in front of a computer and listen to a teacher that's not in the room.
I don't know about you, but I've been enjoying the whole trend of virtual Zoom meetings that have been happening in classrooms.
Really?
That are just getting like crashed by some kid who is who's just like not focused or just doing something silly. And that you're just watching this teacher be so powerless to do anything about it. Because like, you know, if a kid is on their phone, what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to tell them to get off, but they're in their house. Like, there's no control.
Yeah, school mode no is not on at that moment. Yes.
Like, how do you suspend someone? How do you give detention? Like, you know, what type of accountability is there outside of, you know, you might say, well, hopefully the kids themselves are just taking the intrinsic value of education and, you know, seeing the importance of that.
And you know what? We have to start moving forward and thinking forward. We're not going to go back. Even as COVID ends, we're not going to go back pre-COVID. Mm. You know, we like to say at work, like there's after 9/11,
yeah.
There's not such thing as, oh, we went back to before 9/11.
Yeah.
You're not going to get on a plane with a bottle of lotion anymore. Like, it's just not going to happen. We need to think about moving forward. What does this mean for us in the future? And technology seems like an untapped resource that we haven't really completely capitalized on, particularly when we think about education.
So what are your thoughts around this? And again, you know, everyone's coming from this at different perspectives. Are you for a return to school? Are you against a return to school and just keeping things virtual until there's just more clarity and more understanding around this virus and this pandemic? As always, we'd love to hear and read your comments. So visit us, post, and subscribe on our website, imopodcast.com, and on our Instagram at inmyopinion_podcast.
To all the teachers, thank you for your hard work. Hang in there. We are pulling for you.
And as always, this is just our opinion.
Let us know yours.